There's the whistle. Go, go, go. Second half, my three subs action from the Center Circle Studios.
Joining us today from the Memphis area. Raise your hand if you've won an MLS Cup. Brody, you? No?
Nope.
Oh, our guest has.
Yeah.
Welcome, Kerry Talley, to the podcast today. Kerry, nice to see you. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
This is the first time that we've met, so I have so many questions for you.
Well, great. I hope I have a lot of answers for you.
I do, too, because we have to have
the boring show if it wasn't. Huh?
Can I just say how, like, my geek in me is like, yes, toy machines.
Got what is that?
Rocking the sweater there.
You know, I'll be honest. I just bought it for the look of the sweatshirt. I wasn't really sure on the toy machine. But, it's more of a, like, something a little more unique.
The logo's badass. Not even going to lie.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess maybe I'm not as cool as I seem.
No, you're cool. Just keep that way.
All right, good.
I think Brody was hoping that because he also works on another podcast called Geek Tank Radio, which does pop culture and stuff. I think he was kind of hoping that you had like a long story with that.
There's like a tie-in somehow.
But it's okay. Nonetheless, you know, it's funny because we've probably crossed paths before, but just never said hello. No, I didn't go to Houston High School, but I know that you did, and you're partly responsible for one of my friends and one of my coaches back in my high school days of winning a state title in a sport that he didn't even coach in, which is great. So you're part of that great Houston high school group. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the high school team was actually, it was a group of kids that kind of Houston had just come around. So it was all these kids from Memphis Football Club 76 and a team called Fury 76.
Is that Richard Boots' group?
Richard Boots' club was MFC, and still is to this day. It was really probably the largest collection of club soccer players in the city. We had some good times, I guess, just playing there in terms of our success based on, we had the most, even on the bench, there were guys that played club soccer. And, you know, at some of the schools around the area, they didn't even have more than like three or four. So, you know, maybe a little unfair advantage going into most of those games. But, overall, it was a good group.
You played the advantage, that's all.
Yeah.
Not an unfair advantage. That's just how the cards fell.
No, I guess you're right. I like the way you put it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to pull three guys off the pitch just to level the playing field.
Oh, no, guys, it's uneven. You guys got to sit. No, come on. You're not going to sit Pele. Forget that.
We've talked to some of your contemporaries, Ross Pauley, Richard Mulrooney, about this, and I want to get your take on playing high school ball because of the disparity in the talent levels. You know, one day you may be going toe-to-toe with the Christian Brothers, but then you may play another school that's just happy to have 11 guys show up and play. Can you talk about trying to grow your game in while playing high school ball when you have some days that are a little different than others?
There were some difficulties in that. I guess for me as a young player, I maybe had a little bit different focus than a lot of other kids. I was in the U-17 national team at that time, and I would come from playing with, we'd go over, I think we went to a tournament over in France. We played France, Israel, and Portugal, and we're playing against kids that are, they're pros. And then I come back, and I think our first game back is like against Millington. Yeah, it was a little tough to, hey, how do I go from one extreme to the other, but then also how do I go from this extreme to going into like, whoa, we just ramped up the game a million miles per hour compared to what I'm used to right now. So I think that really helped me in terms of a mindset of hey, this is how I want to approach everything. And I knew that if I was going to be better, sometimes it took more than just, hey, just playing in the high school atmosphere. Like, yeah, I really had to dig down and see what kind of character I had and, doing things on my own at night after training, before going to bed, doing just and working myself as hard as I could and pushing myself. And so, it was there were some difficulties in that, especially as you got older. You know, at the younger ages, a freshman, sophomore, hey, there's, you're playing against juniors, seniors, no matter what, they're going to be physically a little bit, more dominant in some aspects. But as you got in your junior, senior year, it was kind of like, a little walk in the park some days.
Right.
And you had to go out and say, it's not going to be in the walk in the park for me.
Right.
I'm going to go. I'm going to play all left-footed today. That's it. And I'm going to play against these
guys. So you would challenge yourself in those, 100%. We'll call them minor games.
And even in some of the top games, you know.
Really?
You know, how can this be a difficult day for me? And so sometimes it would come down to challenging yourself. Sometimes it would come down to, you know, I've got Ross Pauley next to me in midfield. Hey, how am I going to be better than him today?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think he took the same mindset as well. And so, you know, I think more than anything, it was a mental challenge in high school going through that.
Special group, not just at Houston High School because you guys were loaded, but I guess was the plan for MFC and Fury to kind of circle the wagons and bring the best of the best together to be able to compete on a regional basis?
Richard Boot, kind of when he came in, he did this with a MFC 77 group. He said, hey, let's get all the best players in Memphis, put them together, let's see what happens. And that team, the first year, I think, went on, had some success in the state championship and, you know, did okay in regionals. And then it happened for the 76 group, I guess, in probably 92. And we did that, and it went on from there. Like you're mentioning, the group of guys that we had, I mean, there was probably 13, 14 guys going to college on pretty big scholarships, right. Division I colleges. And then you had five guys from that team. And I don't think it's going to be duplicated in the States anytime soon. Yeah, you might have five guys from one team go pro in, say, Kansas City, Washington, D.C., Miami.
Where you have these developmental club kind of things going on.
But we lived within 10 miles of each other.
Yeah.
And really, we played with each other every day, like 18 kids. And you know, you go and you play these other teams now, and they got...
What was in the water around that Houston area at that time?
Excellent.
Can we replicate that?
I'll tell you what it is. It was Richard Boot. That's really? What was in the water. Yep. He had a group of kids, in my opinion, that, hey, we were always striving for something. Hey, you know, we want to be better than this. We want to be seen in this light, and we want to work hard. And he came in, and we had Richard after he'd been in the States, I don't know, for probably 15 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He still wasn't out of the Eastern Bloc European mindset of, like,
go
hey,
hard.
This is going to be tough
yeah.
every day. We're going to work you guys. You're going to know the tactical part of the game. You're going to know the technical part of the game. And when you think that you know it a little bit, hey, it's not good enough. And hey, here's how you're going to keep working.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had guys that he could yell at, he could get into, and he had guys that he had to put his arm around and you know, would
shoulder,
do that. And,
yeah.
And so he was able to have a good mixture of guys that did some, just, you know, good things later on. But more than anything, I think Richard Boot prepared the five of us. If we're just talking about the profession that we went into in soccer, the mental toughness that mm-hmm. I think he gave us far exceeds what most players get. And that's why I think when you see kids, oh, this kid has so much talent, blah, 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 you know, going into a professional team and he's out within a year.
Yeah.
It's because, hey, I don't know if he was really ready for the ups and downs of what comes with it.
Right.
And the daily challenges and the, you know, the, hey, I'm having a great run of games, and I sit down in the locker room and look over, and the coach brings in a center back and says, hey, this is a new center back that's on trial. Make sure this and that. It's like, hold on. I'm a center back.
Yeah.
We've won our last four games. And
here you are looking to replace me.
Yeah, now it's me against him.
Right.
Okay. Hopefully in 2 weeks that guy's leaving. And so other kids or other people may have just said, oh, well,
that's my time. Yeah.
And so I think Richard – more than anything, was able just to instill a work ethic and a mental toughness in that group.
Yeah.
That, you know, hey, we'll do whatever it takes.
Do you think that's a problem within the youth circuit and then moving on to the next circuit now, where you see these guys and, oh, we are touting them. They're going to be national team level. They are our... And there's somebody in the back of my mind that I'm referring to. I won't name names, though. But you know, we're building them up nationally, and then when they get to that level, it just falls. It falls apart, essentially.
Yeah. I don't think I was ever built up to that.
Really?
Like, Richard was never going to tell us, hey, man, you're one of the top kids in the area.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't going to say that. Any day that you walk in, you look now, you go and you see these kids, oh, this kid's this, you know, he plays this way, oh, plays that way. You know, like, what happens?
You never got a pro level, kit with your name on the back going, this is you in 5 years.
Yeah. No, it was, yeah, you've got to work. I'd come back. I came back from World Championships in Japan with the U-17s, and they had watched my whole team had watched the game on Telemundo, I guess it was broadcast, when we played Colombia. And first thing I think Richard said to me was like, I don't think that you played all that great. It's like,
dang.
I'm coming back in.
Welcome back, kid. By the way, you sucked.
Yeah, and it was just like, huh, well, I guess that game's over, and I guess I can't really live off of that.
Right.
I guess what's the next challenge?
Yeah.
And is it the next day? Is it the next minute? Is it next hour? Whatever it is on the soccer field, are you going to be ready for it? Because, yeah. Hey, that's done now. I think you could have been better here. I think you need to work on that.
Kerry Talley joining us on the podcast today. Kerry, how did the spark get lit in you for soccer? And at what point did you just know that that's the path you wanted to take?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it on your on Facebook the other day with your SEMSA jersey on. My cousin played in that league. Geez, I don't even know when. I mean, I was younger than five. I couldn't play yet, but I always remember that little patch on the left side of his shirt, you know, and just be like, oh man, I'd really like to see that. So I'd go and watch my cousin play, and that was back when, you know, nets were only put on goals for the game day.
Right. Yeah.
And they'd string up a bright orange net, you know, stake it down. And I remember every time I'd drive up to the soccer field, I'd be like, I want to see the ball hit that net so bad.
Yeah.
And that's all I wanted to do.
There was
a
distinct sound with that net, too. It was
because the ball was plastic, probably, that you're playing. But, you know, I always remember being, and even to this day, like, as soon as we get to a field, I look at the nets on the goal, and I'm like, you know. And
I wonder what that string music is. Yeah.
And not that I was some big goal scorer or anything, but I was always just like, man, I want to see what happens when the ball hits that net, or how does it get to that point? And you know, soccer is a defensive game. Not many kids back in that day were saying, oh, I can't wait to go play in a game that's 1-0, 2-0, something right. like that. And so, but
I hope we draw.
It was like, yeah, it was like the whole buildup of, oh my gosh, it finally hit the net, you know? And so, I mean, I would say going and watching my cousin early on, him play, and is probably what brought me to the point of, I got to do this.
At what point did you know, okay, I'm on to something? About at what age is like, okay, maybe I should start plotting a path?
Yeah, it was, never really thought too much about that, but.
That's why we do podcasts. Yeah. We help with revelations.
Sit on that chaise.
Yes. So probably around, so the way you used to get to the national team back in the day, I say that, back in like, you know, 88, 89, 90, and so on, is you would go through the Olympic Development Program, ODP. And so what would happen was you would try out for your Western District team here in Memphis,
right.
And the top kids from this Western District would then go to Nashville and play against the two other districts. And then they would pick a state team. And then from there, you'd go and play at a regional camp with your state team against the other 12 states. And then they'd pick a region team. Then the four regions would meet, and they'd pick a national team. So my first year I tried out in, I think, seventh grade. I didn't even make the Western District team. And I was like,
that sucked.
And I remember a coach, and I thanked him at the speech the other day that I gave. I think he was one of the main influences for me, because he said, hey, you know, maybe next year, try again, you know. And I was like, what? Okay, I'll try again. Yes, I will try again. And so I went back the next year and I did that. And, you know, I think 5 years later, I was playing in the World Championships. So, you know, I think right there that was kind of like I like challenges. I've always liked challenges. And especially as a player, no matter when I've played, I've always kind of tried to go in with a bit of a chip and like, hey, I kind of want to feel like this is how I want to look at the end of the day, or this is how I want people to perceive how I play, and this is how I want to feel about the way I play. And I just remember him, and I have no idea who he is. He might have been just a dad that was out there helping, right. But I was like, but I see that guy every once in a while, just his face or kind of the memory in my head of, you know, him saying, yeah, you know, just try again next year, you know, good try. I don't get that, man. No, I'll be back. And kind of from there, that's where it all started, you know, kind of going for me from like seventh, eighth, and ninth. You know, I was getting better and better and starting to gain ground on maybe some of the bigger kids. And then, you know, just things kind of took off one day.
You start having a position sort of picked out in your mind, what you thought you should play.
Yeah, he wanted to hear that string music, baby.
Well,
you want to hear that?
Yeah, I think you know, I always wanted to play in midfield or as a forward.
He's a glutton for punishment in that regard.
Well,
run, kid.
Yeah, and that. Hey, I didn't mind doing the dirty work and getting in there and, you know, trying to make the team work.
Right.
But with this club team that I had we had Richard Mulrooney and Ross Polly in the middle of the field, and I played as. At that time, you played a 3-5-2, or most teams did, and so I was playing as a center back, and so I was always kind of like, man, I'm getting a little bored back here, you know?
Pauly, pass it back, pal.
do center backs attack? Well, they sure do, and you know, and Richard kind of brought a lot of that technical or that tactical aspect to us of, hey, look, it's just not. This isn't how it works. We're not robots.
You don't go in a box.
Yeah. This is, hey, you get the ball here, and now you've got to move chess pieces. Mm. You want to play the ball to a guy on the left wing, and there's a guy in between you. Well, you've got to move him. How do you move him? Move him with the ball or, you know, a little fake here and there just to get him out of the way, and then, oh, you find him. And so really, he put me as a guy in the center of defense there. He had to defend. I could defend, but also like, hey, start the play, bring the ball up the field, look to distribute.
You're more of the chess master at that point.
Well, and he would say, look, you've got, you know, you look at a guy, you know, like Beckenbauer, you know, these guys that could just, you know, they were trying to, you know, dictate the field, and so he was, you know, kind of one of those guys, like, you know, or Cruyff or whoever, these guys that I kind of. That said, hey, I like the way those guys kind of do things, and I would see tapes or whatever, and then, you know, just from there it was, hey, how can you influence the game? How can you be different? How can you outthink kids? How can you outthink players? Because I learned very quickly that I was not the best athlete on the field, and so, but if I was a little bit smarter, a little bit quicker mentally, I was. Loads faster than most of these guys,
right?
And so, you know, that's long and short of it, I guess.
Houston High School. So you guys are dominating there, and you go on back to back state championships.
Yep. 93 and 94, I guess. Yeah.
So did you know? I have to name drop here because these guys were at my alma mater teaching. Do you know Rocky Graves, who might have been in the disciplinary section? I hope you didn't know him other than him supporting you at the games. And Tim Haney.
Oh yeah, Coach Haney. That's he's a
football coach Haney.
Yeah, football coach Haney. He's one of my favorites. In fact, he took over for Houston High School midway through my junior year, and I just remember I had come up to the soccer field, and you know, I had just gotten back from a national team trip, and had come up, and our team's playing, and. Coach Haney standing over there with his arms crossed on the sidelines at the end of the bench. I was like, hey, you're the coach now, aren't you? Yeah. So we went on to win a state title I don't know if he ever knew what was actually going on up there.
It's like Rodney Dangerfield with ladybugs.
He was just, his one thing is he's like, I'm just going to say well done after everything. And, you know, and it went from there.
He's the clapping coach.
Yeah. He's like, hey, well done. Yeah. Well done. Okay, good.
Men of a certain age learn their soccer from Soccer Made in Germany on Channel 10 on Saturday. So
there you go.
That may have been where he saw it. But he's a super nice guy. I know he was a good football coach, and he was really involved with the school. So it's kind of cool that he did that, and you guys rewarded him for that. So.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So, all right, so college is coming to an end, and then it's time to start looking at colleges. Who came courting for you?
Like I said, I had just played in the World Championships for the U-17s going into my senior year of high school. And so I happened to be on a lot of coaches' radars just because, you know, a lot of the top schools were looking, you know, at that team that I was with. And I think my dad had said at one time that, you know, I had 36 full ride offers to schools that to choose from.
It's a whole different kind of pressure.
And you know, just when he's counting, or you know, when we would talk to coaches or whatever, I was like, that number I always remember, whether or not it was true. I think it was. My dad doesn't seem like he'd make that up, but
maybe he even undersold it. You know what I mean? Like, these are the 36 that were like, okay, we could actually go to here, but, you know, and there's like these other 56 that I just threw in the trash because I was like, nah.
And so I went on my recruiting visits to Creighton. I went to University of South Carolina, University of Virginia, and then University of North Carolina. And I enjoyed them all. And there was something about Carolina that I was like, you know, it's in the ACC, and at that point, like, and probably still right now, a lot of the kind of top players tend to go to those schools. They're great institutions across the board, and it came down really between them and UVA, and Bruce Arena was at UVA then, and I was like, you know, they've won so many things. You know, they had won the year prior to me coming. They're always winning. Maybe I could go to North Carolina and maybe I could help them win something.
Yeah.
And so that was more of the way I looked at it. I think, you know, the class that ended up going into UVA that year was a bunch of kids from my U-17 team. And
was there a little pressure then from those other kids? Like, hey, let's keep the band together.
No, it was, you know, we had guys going a lot of different directions. We had kids going, you know, to Clemson. We had kids go to NC State and Duke and Carolina and UVA.
So you saw a lot of those.
Oh yeah, we played against them all the time. And you know, mind you, that the prior U-17 cycle, most of those kids were in those schools as well. And so it was a good, you know, college soccer. I really enjoyed. It was the conference games were very good and tough, I feel.
With going to a UNC, obviously, you think UNC Tar Heels, you think basketball a little bit, especially around that era where, you know, you had a lot of basketball greats coming through. Mm-hmm. Did that kind of alleviate a little pressure from you on campus to sit there and go, hey, you got to win? Because I thought about that with a couple of your other counterparts from high school going to a school that, quite honestly, was a soccer school. Mm-hmm. You know, but UNC, you feel like, well, I don't know, it leans more basketball. Granted, you had titles with soccer as well, but there wasn't that kind of pressure. Or did you feel that pressure?
Yeah, I would think maybe there were eyes because you have Anson Dorrance there in the women's program, which has won so many national titles. And the men's program has always been, at bare minimum, very respectable. And, you know, you
so saw
that's
the on the adverse of that.
You know what? Hey, what will it? You know, we should ask Carrie this.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, the you know, there was, look, when you talk about you know, Anson Dorrance and what he created on the women's side and players that he's had through those doors, and you know, Memphis' own Cindy Parlow, of course, went there at the same time I did. There was a pressure from the sense of, at UNC, it was like 95% in-state kids. And it was all North Carolina people at that school, which I thought was pretty cool. But then you had the athletic community, which, yeah, you had some North Carolina kids, but they were, after that, it was spread across the country, kids from every corner. And so it was, you know, 500-600 people on campus that were athletes that were kind of all in the same boat of, hey, not really knowing people coming in and things like that. But then they go back to their programs. And at that time at Carolina, the women's soccer team was number one. The women's basketball team had just won the year prior the national championship. The men's basketball team was, they had won in 93 as well.
Right.
And then you had the football team that was top 10 that year.
Jeez.
You had baseball that was doing very well. And then it's like, man, we've got to fit into that, you know? And yeah. And that year, we won, I think.
Don't
it was
be the heel.
Yeah. it was called the Sears Cup. I don't know if it's around anymore, but it's where it takes the combined amount of wins for all varsity programs across your school, and it, you know, puts them all together. And hey, you had 780 wins versus Stanford, which had 720, which, you know, then Cal or, you know, just whatever. And then that's determined who won the Sears Cup that year. And I remember our varsity, or, you know, all of our varsity programs was deemed to be the best across all schools in the country that year. So there was a little bit of pressure of, one, you don't want to be second fiddle to the girls program. I mean, but good luck. There's 25 national championships.
As you just name dropped Cindy Parlow's on that squad.
and so, there was a pressure to win for sure at that school.
How's the culture moving from high school to being on a juggernaut to moving in to where everybody else came from, a school that did really well? How was that adjustment for you going from senior year into freshman in college?
You know, there wasn't a whole lot, you know, for me being with that U-17 team and traveling, I mean, 2 and 3 weeks a month in the summer, or missing, you know, 2 weeks at a time because we're going down to Mexico to play or wherever. I think that really set me up to go away for college. You know, most kids are like, oh, this is my last summer at home. I'm like, hey, I got 4 days at home this summer before I go off to school. And that's it. From the time that high school ends to the time I go into, you know, UNC, I had like, it was a very small amount of days. And I was just like, hey, you know, my friends, Memphis will be here.
Mm-hmm.
I can always come back and see people and can always see my friends. But hey, this is what I want to go and do now. So the adjustment for me going into college was more on an academic level, I think, rather than a soccer, a social level. I was okay being away from home, you know, and then the soccer, that was just a, hey, that's what I was there for, in my opinion, was to compete and play. And so I think I kind of thrived in that part, just for me mentally. But yeah, I would say probably academically it was just a little tougher. It's a very good institution, a state school, UNC. And so I had some bumps in the road there, but nothing, you know, that was too major that probably most college kids don't go through.
Well, in all fairness, I mean, it's one thing if Richard Boot's kicking your butt for showing up 30 seconds late and you're motivated to be somewhere that you have a passion about. It's another thing to get up for a 6:55 statistics class on a Monday morning.
No, for sure.
Totally different beast. But looking at your numbers, I think you'd scored like 24 or 25 goals in college. So did you move out of left back or center back a little bit? Did you play a little bit more forward then? Or
I played as mainly a holding midfielder. That's where I played in college. Yeah. And then my senior year, I primarily played as a center back because we had a very young team my freshman year or my senior year. And we had like 10 freshmen and 7 of them were starting. And, you know, we had lost guys like, you know, Eddie Pope. There was these three brothers called the Suarez brothers, Timok, Victor, and Hector, and these guys were dynamite.
I thought you were going to say Luis.
No. you know, and then that kid named Kerry Zavagnin had just left. He's the coach at Kansas City, and I played in Kansas City with him. And so we, you know, we kind of had a everybody leave, and then my senior class was only four guys left from when I started, and so we didn't even have a junior class. A lot of kids had just that class kind of busted, and so we had seniors, freshmen, sophomores, and we struggled the last year. But you know, I was still focused on, hey, how can I help with this team? How can I be, you know, a leader and try and mold myself into getting the group from where we're probably not where we need to be to, hey, competing in these games. And so I another challenge for me that I liked. And then so
Kerry Talley joining us today on the podcast. And during your time in college, this league called Major League Soccer got cranked up as part of the promise from U.S. Soccer to FIFA to host the World Cup in 94. Of course, MLS comes along then, and then comes the MLS draft. At what point did you know or did you know that you were going to be picked for the MLS draft?
Well, I'd gone in with, I guess, my sophomore year with the Olympic team. So I left the semester of school and went to San Diego. I was with the Olympic team in their preparation for Atlanta. And I was released 5 months into that. So, but Bruce Arena was coaching that team. Yeah. And so Bruce kind of got to know me over those 5 months. And then, you know, I played out my last couple of years at Carolina. And, you know, he had just kind of come up to me. They had this kind of all-star senior soccer game against a Division II team, USL team, whatever, to kind of, hey, we're going to play these guys together, and during halftime, they're going to have the top 10 picks. 10 teams are going to pick their kids, and it's all going to be out of you guys. And I was like, okay, great.
So it was like a combine slash draft all rolled into one.
Yeah, and so they were going to do it at the halftime, and I'm sitting there like,
that's a hell of a amount of pressure.
Yeah, and so I have a fantastic game, and I was like, man, I'm flying. I feel good. And DC United was the only team that didn't have a pick in the first round. And so Bruce came to me after the game, and he's like, what's wrong with you? I was like, nothing. I'm a little surprised at that. He's like, don't worry, you'll be taken tomorrow. Like, all right. So I think they had the 13th pick, something like that. And I actually walked in from a pretty heavy night into the conference room. It was literally in a conference room at the hotel we're staying at, of like 12 tables. And I walked in. Walked over to the table, you know, found some water and was like, you know, chugging water. And they're like, and all right, the first pick of, you know, hey, is Kerry Talley. I was like, oh, okay, that's me. it was kind of strange, you know, didn't go up to a stage, didn't talk. It was just like,
did you get a hat?
No chance. No chance I got a hat. Free bowl of soup. No.
Did you get a ride over the conference center?
Oh no! It was in the hotel that I was staying.
He was staying at the hotel. Yeah. He didn't have to get the ride over.
So free elevator ride.
Yeah. So I just kind of cartwheeled out of bed and into the elevator. And
who was the first phone call you made when you got drafted?
Oh, it had to have been my mom and dad. You know, my mom and dad, they were huge in my soccer development. And you know, as you guys probably know, Mike Rose Soccer Complex is here today because my father and mother were so heavily involved in soccer.
Oh, yeah, your family, yeah. I mean, they're like the patron saints of Memphis amateur and rec soccer. No, and I say that with the utmost respect because there's a lot of sweat equity and goodwill that they've put into this community to make it grow as it has. As somebody that's played out there, well, I call it playing.
Yeah, but it's playing.
Yeah. I've run around a couple times.
No, but in all seriousness, well, anybody that's ever played out there owe a debt of gratitude to his family. Anyway, I digress. But anyway, I did want to pay respect to your family in that aspect.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah. You know, they were definitely the first ones that I called, and they were such a big part of, like I said, just my development. And my dad, he was a great man. But he always had kind of this, you know, just, I don't know, there was something about him that I was always like, man, I gotta do better. And he knows I can do better. I mean, and so, I don't know. I loved having my dad around, and you know what he went and did when I went off to college, and putting this business plan together for the Mike Rose and working with the county on it. And when I came back to it, I was like, wow, this is great. He's like, this is because we used to have to drive you guys all around the country.
Yeah.
And I was like, why don't we have people come to us? And so that's how the birth of Mike Rose came about.
And then the tournament named in the family's honor, it has blown up.
Yeah.
There. I mean,
yeah.
It just stays packed out there. And I know that helps bring in revenue for the county. It brings in for Mike Rose, and it employs a lot of referees.
I mean, you go out there on a Saturday.
It's a huge deal, that annual tournament.
Yeah, and you know, the Lobos, they do tournaments out there. You know, we're having an ODP tournament out there this weekend, and there's a lot of games played out there. Last year we had 9,000 games played out on those fields. And
that doesn't surprise me, but it's when you hear that number, that's huge.
Yeah. because it's 17 field complex. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and so it's a lot of wear and tear. And look, these guys in maintenance, they work their tails off, and you know, working their tails off when grass isn't growing. It's, you know, it's a lot of work out
and
there.
And now you got professional soccer getting played out there.
U.S. Open Cup, yeah. Yep. I mean, that would not probably be possible.
Yeah.
You had the home away from home games for the USL.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So you know, it's I love going out to that complex. I was a little, I always saw myself coaching professionally, and, you know, especially towards the end of my career, but when my mom called, you know, after I was like, hey, we went on a family trip in December, and I just said, hey, I think I'm going to call it quits here. You know, just hang up the boots there and time to move on to the next chapter of my life. And she's like, well, would you like to come back and work at Mike Rose? And I was like, well, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it in terms of being a professional coach, my family was a very young family at the time. You know, my son was 6 years old. My daughter was 2. There was a part of me that was like, I got to see these kids grow up every day. And I knew the demands of an MLS season. It's about 11 and a half months for the coaches. You get about 2 weeks off at the end of the year. But, hey, when the CBA – you know, CBA probably guarantees like 5 weeks off. I forget what it is. Like when players are allowed to leave, that means coaches hit the road, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was like, well, maybe I think it'd be good to go home. Mm-hmm. And let's just see what this is. I'll get into youth soccer. And for me, it was the best thing I could have done.
Yeah.
You know, I get to see my kids play every night, turning into fantastic little soccer players. And for me, who still has coaching aspirations, mind you, in terms of I'm coaching youth soccer now. I'm the director of a small club.
Free plug, fire away.
Oh, the Germantown Legends.
Okay.
Yep. So we've now started producing some very good teams at these older age groups. And so for me, in terms of being a coach, coming back and instead of going right into, say, Real Salt Lake and then being an assistant coach there, or maybe working in their academies and stuff like that, it allowed me to really take the game, which I've always tried to be better than my opponents tactically, because like I said, I wasn't the most athletically gifted kid. I could run, I could move, I could jump, I could, you know, do whatever, but
sure,
like I wasn't blowing anybody out of the water with my speed. Right. And then, so I had to take what I knew at this level and not break it down just for the best kids in the academy that, hey, these kids are coming in, they're already good, you know, this and that. No, I've got to break it down to, how do I take this and break it down to a 9-year-old?
Yeah, and the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, and it's like, no, you just got to pass the ball, kid. Well, how do I pass it? Oh, well, now you got to move your foot like this, and your heel's got to be, try and put your heel down, your toe up. Yeah, okay. So now I'm taking the game from this level, and I'm like, man, I really got to chop, 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 chop this. Mm-hmm. And so it allowed me, I feel, to see the game in a way different light than certainly when I was playing But now when I watch games, I just look at them a little bit differently than a player, I think. So.
Well, and you had the clout, you know, once you went into to coaching.
Yeah, hey, would love to hear about after you got drafted, you went to DC United. What was that like going into camp, being the new guy? Was that intimidating? What were some things on your takeaways in heading into that first season?
So DC United, when I came in, had just won. They had won it in 96, and then they had won it in 97, the MLS Cup. I was coming in 98. And so I had guys that were, you know, that had been there, done that in MLS, but not only that, they'd been there and done that on the world stage.
Yeah.
I had, you know, the captain, a great guy. I love him to this day, Marco Echeverri.
Yeah.
You know, I remember watching him in the World Cup and him getting red carded within like the first like 30 seconds and being like, man, that dude with the hair, I can't believe that. Well, I'll never see him again. Well, next thing you know, years later, I'm playing with him. Great captain, great guy, fantastic soccer player. And at that time, it was like him, Valderrama, and Maradona, the top three guys in South America that were kind of like most widely known, I would say.
Did you play with Jaime Moreno?
And then Jaime Moreno was there. He was, you know, I think maybe 3 or 4 years older than me, but. Yeah. I mean, he had played at Middlesbrough before that and, you know, grown up in this Taiwichi Academy down in Bolivia that was famous for quite some time, just producing Bolivian players. And so, you know, I came in, you know, John Harkes was also there. It was fun. They took me under their wing, and at that time there was only 18 roster spots. And so I had to come in and really knock guys out. You know, they had, I couldn't tell you how many guys were in at the first camp, but it was a weeding out process, of course. And I knew I was up for it. And at the end of the day, like I said, I was there, on the roster, 18 man roster at the end of preseason. So it was, but those guys that were seasoned pros, they were great to be around. If I would have gone to another club, I think in MLS, I wouldn't have nearly had the career that I would have had if I didn't go through DC United.
It's because they were comfortable in their own skin knowing that they had already accomplished and they were very confident in who they were.
Oh, I think so. I think so. And they loved to compete. Like practices, there were some days I would walk out of practice and be like, that was tougher than the game this weekend. You know, it's and it was a culture that Bruce Arena had kind of obviously cultivated with this competition and refusing to lose and wanting the best out of yourself, and that fit in right in with my mindset as it was, and so yeah, it was a great experience.
So you got through the rookie season. I think Chicago won the double that year in '98, but then '99 mm-hmm. comes calling, and then it's your time. Can you talk a little bit about that run to the title?
Yeah, I in my first year we won the CONCACAF Champions League.
That's right. It's the last American team to do that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think LA Galaxy won it a few years later, but we beat Lyon, Toluca. We beat Toluca in the final, and they were a great team. They had guy Fabian Astai from Chile. There's the guy, their most famous goal scorer, Cardoza, that scored so many goals in the Mexican league. And this is a good team we're playing against, and we went and beat them, and so we won that. And then in December we beat Vasco da Gama in a home, and we'll call it away, but they were like, hey, we're going after we play you guys over to Japan to play in the World Club Championships against Real Madrid. And
jeez.
And we're kind of like, hold on, why aren't we invited to that?
Yeah.
Because they beat us at home 1-0. We beat them 2-0 in Miami and won the Inter-American Cup, which is the champions of North and South America.
And was that one of the last years that they did that? Because I don't even think that one's – is that even around
I don't
now?
I don't think
or
it's around anymore.
Something else?
Could
yeah.
be.
Yeah, but seriously, why weren't you guys invited to that? I mean,
no, we were wondering the same thing because I don't know who – the year that we lost or I'm sorry, the following year we played in the competition – and we lost to Necaxa, and Necaxa went on to play like Manchester United and a couple other teams over in Brazil for the World Club Championship. And we're like, hey, we won. We should have been over there. And,
yeah.
And look, we would have gotten smoked by Real Madrid just like Vasco did. It was that Vasco da Gama team, they were good. They're very good. And that was something for me, considering 12 months earlier, I was playing against like, you know, ACC competition, and now I'm playing against Juninho, and I'm just like, holy cow.
How did we get here?
Yeah, and so it was, that year was a great year in terms of like the culture of winning.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, this is what I want to happen every year, every time we play. And so Bruce Arena left, went to the national team, 99, and then I had a run of, I think I played in almost every game that season in 99, but I started like maybe half the games.
Who'd you beat in the final?
We beat LA Galaxy, and that was at Foxborough. And it was great. There was, 50,000 people, and they seemed to all be DC United fans, so which was pretty
that was
cool.
Nice.
And so we won that game. It was probably wasn't the prettiest game. I mean, the field was total garbage. that's what I remember most
was
about
that before
it.
Before Gillette Stadium?
Yes, it's before they knocked out.
Oh yeah, that field was garbage. Yeah.
And so
wow.
And all aspects, all sports, that was terrible.
Yeah. But it was a great time. I was like, finally, we won an MLS Cup. I feel like I want to win the US Open Cup, and that's the only domestic trophy that I'll have left. But it was, for me, that last, I guess it was like four games, there's a guy that played right back, and I played right back that season a majority, Diego Senora. Diego Senora had spent years and years at Boca Juniors, played right back for Boca Juniors in their heyday and stuff like that. Well, that guy, that's who I was competing against mainly. So I was getting a run when maybe he was injured maybe a center back was injured. They'd plug me in. And, so I still had a good run of games, but he went down in the playoffs. And I remember being like, okay, he's fit for the playoffs. And right before the game that we were about to play in against Columbus in the first round, he goes out to warm up, and I'm on the bench, and I'm like, man, I was having a good run right before this. Okay, I'll be ready. He goes down in warm ups, and Rongan's like, okay, be ready, puts me in, and I have a good run of games there, and we get to the final, and Senora's fit again. It's like, man,
dude,
are you gonna play a guy that's played at Bombonera in Argentina? I mean, in front of millions and millions of people, and lives are on the line, and are you not going to start this guy in the MLS Cup over a pretty green kid who's only in his second year? And Rongan said, hey, I'm going to stick with you. And I'm always in, whenever we talk about it, I was like, man, for me, that was probably one of the toughest decisions for you. And he's like, oh, for sure it was, So I had a good game. From that game, got called into the national team, and I guess all part of being a professional, or with some successes becomes, there's some opportunities that come along with it. Yeah. So yeah.
Were you the corner kick taker on that side?
No, I was. Hey, I told you I wanted to score. I was getting in the box. Yeah. I was always getting in the box.
You were throwing the bows.
Oh, if there was a corner kick, I'm in the box.
So, I know you scored like 20 in your career, but you also scored in the playoffs too. Did you score in 99, or was it another playoff year?
Oh, geez. It was probably another year.
By the way, congratulations. You do hold the record for most red cards to have ever appeared on this podcast with 5.
All right.
Congratulations for that.
Hey, well,
fistful of cards, buddy.
When you play in the back, sometimes those things happen. And,
is there a single card that sticks out in your head that you're like, yeah, I totally deserve that?
I would think at right back you would be at risk for that anyway, because there's so much running involved intermingling of legs by accident and tugging of shirts, which didn't,
There's, like I said, Landon Donovan would always find his way over to the left side of midfield when they were playing against us. And I was like, gosh,
this guy.
Yeah, this guy has rockets in his rear. He can fly. And I was like, oh, my God. And so, hey, you know, I'm sure I tugged on him a few times because he just got a step or something like that. But there's a red card I remember. We played Chicago. We went and played Chicago my first year at Soldier Field, packed house. Great atmosphere. I mean, this fog over the top of the stadium. It was
almost like a dome at
the point. Oh, yeah. They had these two Polish guys and a Czechoslovakian. Then it was Czechoslovakia, I think, or Czech Republic, whatever. Guy, Lubos Kubik, was there, who had played in the World Cup and, like, marked Maradona out of the game in Italy. You know, so we were playing against these guys coming in, first-year team. It was going to be a great game, and it was. And I got red carded in, I don't know. We were up, I think, 2-1, and we lost 3-2 after I got red carded. So that's probably one that sticks out the most.
Yeah. Hurt a little bit.
You know. You live and you learn. You're sitting there in the locker room, and you're like, oh, okay, we're up 2-1. Hopefully we can hold on. Then you hear the crowd go, and you're like, ooh, okay, 2-2. Hopefully, well, there it goes again. 3-2, you know, darn it. So we end up losing.
I always wondered about that. When you get carded, you know, when you take that long walk, okay, the proverbial walk of shame, you know, back to the the locker room, I always wondered about the mindset of some guys. I know what my mindset was when I got carded. I got my fair share. But I always wondered, like, when you're sitting in the locker room and you got the packed house and you're hearing, maybe you're away like you were in Chicago, and you're hearing that and you're like, shut up.
Yeah.
Just shut up.
No, there is. Actually, that brings me to another red card that I got. You know, I had a lot better instances than just those red cards in my career.
Yeah.
But
we're just dwelling on this right now.
Yeah, they do stand out a little bit. But there was a time I played at Dallas, and we went and played San Jose, and we were up 1-0. And we had this kid on the outside named Ramon Nunez, who was, I think he was 17, 18-year-old kid. Right. And the center back for San Jose was a guy named Eddie Robinson. Well, I played college soccer with Eddie Robinson at North Carolina. And he goes and just hammers this guy on the sideline. And then as he gets up, he shoves the kid. Well, the ball is rolling to me as I'm running over towards him, and I smash it right at Eddie. And it hits him, and he turns around, and he kind of shoves me at the same time. Well, I take, you know, the palm of my hand, I just smash it into his face. And, like,
it's a brawl at this point.
Yeah, it went off right there. And okay, handbags, I think they call it. Yeah, there's a lot of shoving after that. And so I walk up the tunnel at Spartan Stadium, and Eddie's walking behind me, and then we sat in the locker room together because, I mean, we were college teammates at one time, and we're just kind of sitting there, and we were up 1-0, and kind of hear the crowd go, and you're like, well, all right, 1-1. Please, and we're just. Next thing you know, we were literally sitting in the same locker room, and just hanging out. Yeah. And so it was kind of interesting.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
You were at Dallas. Was that when they went from the Burn to FC Dallas? Were you there for that transition?
Oh yeah, I was there for the transition. Yeah. So it was.
Was Shellis the coach then?
No, a guy named Colin Clark was. Okay. Colin Clark played for Northern Ireland in the World Cup in '86. He was a great coach. A guy named Steve Morrow was there too. He is famous for being picked up at Wembley Stadium by Martin Keown and picked up over his head after he scored a goal at Wembley, and Keown drops him over his shoulder and he lands on his arm. His arm's like sticking out, and they have to stretcher him off the field. So that's his like most famous Arsenal story. If anybody knows Steve Morrow, they know that story. So that's pretty interesting. But
I've seen the pictures from that too. By the way, it's gnarly.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It reminds me of the Lawrence Taylor tackle on Heisman, but you know, with a leg or whatever. Kerry Talley joining us on the podcast today, and with experience at Real Salt Lake. Chivas, how was Chivas? By the way, I know that was kind of like the final years of Chivas, and that really wasn't reflective of what was going on the field. I don't know, was it not the right time for two LA teams?
You know, I think it was tough. You know, you had Vergara, who is the owner of Chivas Guadalajara. This was more of a headache for him, I think, because he wanted to have all Mexican-American players, just like they have at Chivas Guadalajara, is all Mexican players. There's no foreign players there. Well, they tried that the first year. Total bust. Total bust. And so then they brought in Bob Bradley, and, you know, he brought in a bunch of old guys from his Fire days, Ante Razov, Jesse Marsh, guys like that that were leaders. They were good players in the league, and then from there, they had Preki. Preki was my roommate at Kansas City. This guy's 38 years old, and I'm 25 to Kansas City. He's like, "You room with me?" I was like, "Okay."
Is he as interesting as I think that he would be? Because he played indoor for a long time, and then he played at Everton, and then he plays over here.
Yeah.
Have you got a good Preki story?
Oh. Preki, I think the reason he and I hit it off so well is a lot of people don't like him because he just kind of tells it how it is.
Yeah.
You're like, "Oh, you think I had a good game?" I'll be like, "Oh, no, well, I don't think that you're very good, but yeah, okay, you had a good game." It's like, "Oh, wow, all right."
Damn.
Pretty honest with you.
Right.
For me, it was like I was rooming with Richard Boot.
Yeah.
I knew how to deal with a guy from Poland. I could deal with a guy from Serbia or, you know, former Yugoslavia. But the stories he would tell, you know, he was over at in Belgrade and at Red Star Belgrade. And then the reason why he, I believe, came over was because he had to have 2 to 4 years in the army or something like that. So he came over to the U.S., played in indoor with like Tacoma Stars or something like that, completely tore it to pieces, and then went back, played at Portsmouth, played at Everton, and so then he, you know, came to MLS, obviously. But I remember there being practices. I'm 25. He's 38 years old. And I'm like, how can I take myself seriously as a professional? And this guy goes out every day and destroys everybody on the field. Nobody could touch him.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
And he's 10 years the senior.
Of some of our most senior players.
Right.
And it's just like, oh my gosh. How's this guy this good at this age?
Yeah.
And so, but Preki, you know, in terms of a coach at Chivas, he brought me from Salt Lake to Chivas because he was like, "Hey, I want to get you here. I want guys that I'm familiar with." And that spoke a lot to me because it showed that, hey, he had a respect for me as a player, and he's a guy that's like, you know, very difficult for him to give a compliment to any players. You know, you'd be watching Ronaldo. Nah, maybe not as good with his left foot. You know. Okay, thanks.
Shut up, man.
But in terms of tactically, I fit into his systems because, look, he didn't defend a whole lot as an attacking player, but with the ball, he was fantastic. And he just didn't defend a lot. But with a team, it was like, hey, this is how we're going to look. This is how we're going to be tough to be broken down all the time because I know what's tough for me as an attacking player to play against. And so our teams defensively were great. And those Chivas teams that I played on, they were very good.
Who was your keeper? Was it Kennedy was your keeper? Who was
Dan Kennedy was there. Zach Thornton, a guy named Zach Thornton that was at Chicago for a while. We had, you know, like Sasha Kleischen, who was a young player in the national team, and then a kid named Johnny Bornstein, who I think scored the winner against Costa Rica or Honduras to put Costa Rica into the World Cup. And, you know, he had a nice little, is still having a nice career. And then, you know, Ante Razov, Jesse Marsh, like you talk about a guy that was a captain, that guy embodied what it was to be a captain. And for those of you that don't know who he is now the coach at Red Bull Salzburg.
And was this close to making the knockout stages this year.
Yep. And, you know, they went into, and if you ever get the chance, go check the video of him in the locker room of the Liverpool halftime speech, you'll want to run through a wall for the guy.
It's like half English, half German, right?
And yeah, yeah,
just,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's on fire.
And
he
lights into the team, but then, you know, gives them this, hey, this absolute confidence. Hey, this isn't, you know, this isn't a friendly, you know, hey, we're giving these guys too much respect. And they come out, they're 3-0 down at halftime. They go 3-3, and then Liverpool pulls one back. But I talked to him right after the game. I was like, dude, that was one of the best soccer moments in my life. I wasn't even involved in it. Yeah. But just watching you and all that. And so we had a nice conversation about it.
And then he just lost Erling Haaland, right? And I think he just left for Dortmund, but they still seem to be doing okay in the Austrian league.
Oh, yeah, they're going to blow through that Bundesliga. You know, and look, I'll be honest, I talked to him about, hey, is there any chance my son could maybe come in with the youth team over there for a week or 2 weeks? And he's like, look, we just bought two 15-year-olds for $2.5 million each. If he compares in that, that's something that we could look at, but this is how this machine works. And I was like, well, you're in luck. He's only $1.5 million. I'll give him to you for a bargain. He didn't bite. He didn't bite. So
next time you get him.
but anyway, he's like, we got these kids at 15. By 19, they're out the door. We've sold them for 10 times the investment we're putting into them. And that's kind of the same case with the Holland guy, the Minamoto guy. They bring them in for small amounts, and then they sell them for these gigantic fees, and that's what Red Bull want to do. And and I think in that youth Champions League that their youth team is in, they've done well across Europe, and they're just churning out these younger players that are going into the first team and doing well in Europe. Yeah. So, but I think a lot of that comes down to Jesse and the way he motivates, and he's tactically a very, very intelligent guy. So,
and just getting started, really.
Yeah, just getting started. I think that guy can go to a lot of clubs. I think he's gotten through the stigma of, hey, this is an American coach. You know, Bob Bradley obviously didn't do well when he was over at Swansea, but right. You give any guy 8 games with no money, what do you expect?
Right.
And so,
do you think Bob got the bad rap?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
He's won everywhere else.
I know. Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like,
the guy's a very good coach. He's a smart man. He's he gets a lot out of his teams. And I think he went to, I forget where in Norway.
And then he coached Egypt for a bit, right?
He coached Egypt. And you talk about going through some stuff over there. Like, that's when the
political stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they bombed their offices and stuff like that. So he was, but he almost got him to a World Cup. That's what they wanted. Right. But they lost in the Cup of Nations, I think. I think Jesse was underneath Bob at, I guess with the national team right after his career, and then went over to Red Bull or Montreal, then Red Bull. And then he went to Red Bull, Leipzig, and was the assistant there. And it's just like, hey, this is how it is. This coach is going to move on. We're going to place this guy here next year, and then you're going to go to Salzburg. So it was already like predetermined. It's like, we got to get it straight now. Yeah. And by the time the changes come, you should be ready. So it's interesting talking to him about those things.
Well, thanks for sharing that, because we've talked about him frequently on here, especially during the Champions League stages, about how of a regard we hold him in. You know, everybody's talking about Liverpool and talking about PSG and Real and all them, but I mean, don't sleep on Salzburg.
Yeah, that's they're fun to watch. Yeah. I like their energy. I like the way they press for really 90 minutes, and it's not something that in modern soccer that you see a lot right now. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at you watch many leagues around the world, they turn around, they lose the ball, and then there are literally 11 guys almost 45 yards outside the goal mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just defending in a group, and it's guys getting in gaps, getting in between in the lines there, and getting balls played into them, quick combinations, chance on goal.
Right.
Like, no, they go and press high up the field, and they they put you under for 90 minutes, and I think it's a lot different style than a lot of people in Europe are playing.
By the way, congratulations, because I guess a week or two ago, you got inducted into the Tennessee Hall of Fame for soccer.
Yeah,
congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. No, that was a
Hall of Famer.
That was a big honor for me, and I told the guys that nominated me that I've always been proud to be from Tennessee, and wherever I've gone, national team camps, MLS, wherever it is. So I was like, yeah, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. Always super proud to be from here. Went to North Carolina, I'd wear a Memphis State basketball shirt, hey, I loved Memphis, and I love being able to say that I'm from here. And so, when they obviously gave me that award, I let them know, like, hey, I'm going to carry this with me because it's something, that I've obviously always been proud of, to be from the state. And now you guys are giving me this honor within, the soccer community. That's really special to me.
Now, having the professional club, the USL in Memphis, and mm-hmm. then having the, now the MLS team in Nashville, what kind of weight does that have for you?
It's great to see. I know Tim Howard very well. I know Tim Mulqueen very well. He was with us I was with him in Kansas City. He was an assistant coach while I was in Kansas City. And so we've had some really good conversations. And just, talking about soccer over dinner and, just things like that. I think it's great that the city has embraced that team down in that area, down at Redbird Stadium. I've gone and watched a couple of games, and the atmosphere is great. Mm-hmm. And I think the soccer is this year, and seeing the team is going to be better than last year's team for sure. And it's not easy putting out a franchise, a first year team, and expecting to get these huge results. It just doesn't happen. But I think the building blocks that, Tim Mulqueen is setting out with Tim Howard coming in is going to be very good for the soccer audience, in my opinion, of people watching down there, and it'll be a better product on the field. So
yeah, I think the future looks bright. But about a week or so ago, when we did our podcast with the three original Rogues front office guys, we talked about how when the Rogues came to town, there was one soccer field. There was one field, basically, Wilson Field.
Right.
And parents were volunteers. They weren't knowledgeable about the game, but now the kids that have grown up have become that generation, and now we've got another generation. And thanks to the facilities like Mike Rose Soccer Complex, we have a very much better informed, more of a soccer culture here, which made it ripe for a 901 FC. So, again, I don't want to belabor the point, but I do want to thank you and your family for the contribution to this community. In fact, I met my wife out at Micro Soccer.
Oh, nice.
You're playing summer ball. I don't know if she'd thank you, but I did.
Yeah. But, no, that's awesome.
But it's been a pleasure having you in, Kerry. Thank you. You've been extremely generous with your time. Germantown Legends, right? Club ball?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You guys got a website or anything?
Yeah, GermantownLegendsSoccer.com. Yeah.
Okay.
You can go check out. We've got some good little older teams. And in fact, Tim's been nice enough to let a couple of our young, 15, 16-year-old kids come and train with their group, and they've done well. So I think there's definitely some kids out of Memphis that that you can keep your eye on in terms of maybe, well, of course, going off to play college, but who are really now 901s here in Nashville down the street, giving those kids like more of a, hey, this is an attainable goal for me.
Yeah.
And, I never had that. I never had that. I was like, well, I guess I'll go play in Europe, I guess. And then MLS came around. I was like, well, give it a try. But now these guys can grow up and possibly go right into that. That's great for them.
Hey, last question. The jerseys in the early MLS were not Climalite, were they?
Oh, no. I've got my MLS Cup jersey on the wall, and I'm surprised the nails can support the frame because – it's like a full-on hockey sweater, the big three lines stitched across the thing. It's, it's not like it was. Like, I wore a large, jersey, but it literally, in this day and age, would probably be a double XL on people. Huge baggy sleeves, and yeah, wasn't very flattering.
I still drink Sierra Mist to this day. I remember the patch on
the
side.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Do you remember who the sponsor was for DC?
MasterCard.
Okay.
Was it MasterCard?
MasterCard, yeah. So a pretty cool opportunity came about. Like, MasterCard was doing something. Pele was their big guy. And so, like, our team went and did something with Pele. So I've got a picture of me and Pele up there in,
awesome.
My bar at home. And it's like, I mean, that's
when people
royalty.
Come over, you're like, yeah, there's Pele.
Yeah, that's kind of royalty, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a little 3x5 in a frame, you know? But it's like, we have a Brazilian kid on our team. The family came over and they were hanging out. And the mom kind of just starts staring. And she's like, is that Pele? I was like, yes, it is.
Yeah, well, yes, it is.
Yes, it is. So, no, but yeah, that was our sponsor. So.
Oh, that's cool.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Kerry, it's been a blast. Hey, please don't be a stranger. We'd love to have you back if you had a good time. We'd love to, and we wish you the best of luck with Germantown Legends. And thanks for coming in and give us a little bit of time on My Three Subs.
No, I appreciate you guys having me. I'll come back anytime. You just let me know.
More next on My Three Subs, a soccer odyssey.
I love talking soccer, but I also love talking about real estate, too. And people ask me about both a lot. And one of the big questions I get in real estate is, how's the housing market? The housing market looks great, and interest rates are near historical lows. And really, it all comes down to, when is the time right for you? If you're ready to make your move, give me a call. Tim Van Horn at Cry Like Realtors, 901-756-8900 is my office number. Brody, can I give him my cell number? Oh, I can? Okay. 901-262-5000. That's my cell phone. You can also go to my website, timvanhorn.com. I can help you with your move around the block, around the city, around the state, and even around the world, too. I have a network of relocation certified agents just ready to help you. They are dying for your business, and I can put you in touch with those. All it takes is pick up the phone, give me a call. 901-756-8900. That's my office number. You can call me at my cell, 901-262-5000. Or just go online. Check me out at timvanhorn.com. That's timvanhorn.com with Cry Like Realtors.
This is My Three Subs, a soccer odyssey. And we have added time to the podcast.
Let's throw this out there, too, because this is a big injury. And we're just getting a statement from Tottenham Hotspur about Son. We noticed after his game, of course, he had a game-winning goal against Aston Villa ahead of time over the weekend. But he's also been holding his arm, flinching it in what looked to be a lot of pain. Come to find out, he has a fractured arm. And now the statement comes out that he is going to be missing significant time because he is required to have surgery. But Jose Mourinho, let me go before. Jose Mourinho is actually going even further than the statement, saying that he's not going to count on Son coming back at all for the rest of the season. So you got Kane, that blows my mind. Kane is already out through at least April. Son with a fractured arm, which doesn't look like it surprises him. Because I figured there would be a way that maybe he could play. I mean, we're in mid-February right now. But now, that throws a whole different wrinkle into things. Because if Manchester City's ban is held up, that really, at this point, throws it into even more chaos for that final Champions League spot. And to kind of recap that, Manchester City has been charged with violating financial fair play, with their crisis, 30 million euro fine, and a 2-year ban from all European tournaments, which would obviously include the Champions League, and would also include UEFA. So at this point, if you look at the standings for Manchester City in second, you pull them out and you go 1-3-4-5, you have Liverpool, Leicester, Chelsea, and Tottenham, who, as of this podcast, some dark Tottenham right now, you have
by, because to me, Jose's a pretty straight shooter, and you can believe every single word that comes out of his mouth.
Yeah.
I think maybe he's just tempering expectations, and maybe the chance he comes back in May for the final run, which is when we would need him. If you have him in pain back, that would be great.
Yeah.
And if he has this surgery, there's nothing saying that he can't do the cardio work on the side and stay match fit. Now, getting those touches, that's a whole different beast, but at least cardio-wise, he can do it. So, you've got to look at the standings at Kenworth. They're in right now by 1 point. You have Sheffield United, who is 1 point back. You have Manchester United, who is 2 points back. And then just looking over the shoulder, I'll even go 8, 9, and 10 because I think Wolves have an opportunity. Everton has an opportunity. Their goal differential is the worst of anyone in the top 10. It's a -4, so that's a strike against them. They're going to have to get a spot outright. And then even Arsenal at 34 has a shot. I'm going to rule out Burnley at this case just because Burnley's goal differential is -9. But I would go as far as saying that the rest of that group in the top 11 could maybe snag a couple of Europa spots. Because remember, that spot slides down. So, okay, Arsenal.
Not riding them in.
Right.
Here's your paper.
Okay, I see you drew a line down the middle of the page, and you have Sheffield United in pencil on the right side. So I guess your favorites are on the left, and then if I'm wrong, it might be this team that makes me wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, so safe to say, would you be comfortable saying any of the top nine could be maybe vying for that last spot if they get hot enough?
I think they can.
And I think Everton's going to have to get hot with Mina and with Carlson and Calvert-Lewin to be able to get in there. I think they are the outsiders of the top nine. But if you put enough swerve on it can happen. So Manchester City has opened up some opportunities. Alex Keating.
Thanks, Vinny.
By the way, for those that have not heard why, the allegations are based upon financial fair play, which says you can only spend how much you bring in. They're alleging that money was funneled into sponsorships via the essentially giving them almost a blank checkbook to go out and get clicks. Supposed to be doing that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's the rules they agreed to abide by.
Well,
before we go, a couple of congratulations. You mentioned Johnny Walker, who's a Bulls fan, who's the assistant. He's the assistant men's head coach at University of Memphis for the women's soccer team. Three of the women are on the Canadian under-20 national team coming up for the CONCACAF tournament coming up shortly. So congratulations to them for that. And then we want to send out congratulations to our friend of the podcast, Mark Graney, because this week it's available. In fact, right now as you're listening, his brand new book called 1 Minute Out, it's his 9th in this series. It is available now. It's up at a bookstore. You can go
Amazon, and he's also going to be at Novel Bookstore in Memphis, in East Memphis, on Saturday, where you can, he's doing a meet and greet, and you can get an autographed copy and meet Mark. He's a big friend of the program. Go to markgradybooks.com and find out more. And you go to microsoftpodcast.com and find out a bit more about Mark, because we've got a great interview with him at the beginning of the show. And Instagram, I think, is MyTreeSubSoccer. And if you have any angry exultations, or if you want to send us an email, tell us how awesome we are, MyTreeSubPodcast.com. Oh, that's right, MyTreeSubPodcast.com.
There's the whistle. Thank you for listening. Check out more My Three Subs podcast, A Soccer Odyssey.
Hey, it's Tim. Just reminding you, this podcast is now powered by Podcave, the complete toolkit for podcasters. Brody and I want all of our time going into making the podcast as entertaining and as interesting as possible for you. So that's why we ditched our old services, made the switch over to Podcave. This is the complete podcast management, combining all the tools we need to make the best shows we can, to make them available on all the platforms you use, and to always stay connected with you. Podcave provides unlimited audio storage, so all our episodes, new and the old ones, are always available whenever you want them. And our website, it's included and built into Podcave, so you always have a place to find us. It's that easy. Music and soundscapes we use on the show are professionally made and fully licensed by Podcave, so we don't worry about getting sued for using music without permission, and we know for sure that the artists who made it, well, they're getting paid, and that's always a great thing. We get email and text management tools to stay in touch with you, guest booking tools, episode planning tools. Podcave even includes customizable news feeds so that we can stay on top of the latest headlines. We used to have to piecemeal all that stuff, and it took hours. Believe me, it took hours. It cost hundreds of dollars every month, and we had to have all these different accounts to really get the podcast to you. Well, that's all changed with Podcave. It's all in one place, and it's all inclusive. You're going to scratch your head, and you may even have to scratch your ears when you hear this. It's all inclusive for just $49 a month. That's right, $49 a month. Podcave, the complete toolkit for podcasters. Save time and money with your first or next podcast. Don't be afraid. Give it a try. Use Podcave. That's podcave.com. That's P-O-D-C-A-V-E, podcave.com.